Hey everyone, it's Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 97th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today you are in for a treat. We are talking to TJ Thompson, the incredible guitar repairman, guitar builder, guitar MacGyver. He is the guru when it comes to vintage Martin guitars, and we just can't get enough of him. He's been on the podcast before. We featured him in the magazine before, and I wanted to talk to him today about his new website. He's always had a pretty low web presence and preferred it that way, but he recently launched a store called ProLuthierTools.com, and there you can find some of the tools, some of the parts that he has been developing over the last couple of decades. You can order them. He's got belly bridges, he's got pyramid bridges, he's got all sorts of crazy and innovative tools that a professional repairman might need when restoring or working on a vintage acoustic guitar. And I wanted to hear him talk about this because even though this stuff is pretty esoteric and pretty geeky, he is one of the most entertaining guys around. And as you will hear, he is using aerospace engineering when it comes to some of this stuff, modern technology, all sorts of wacky things. So you will enjoy this episode. If you are into vintage guitars and how they are repaired and how they are restored, I encourage you to go back a couple of podcast episodes. We did a vintage guitar restoration panel at the Fretboard Summit back in November. That featured Jim Baggett of Mass Street Music, Mark Stutman of Folkway Music, Richard Johnston of Griffin Strings, Eric Schoenberg and Jay Hostetler of Stumac. They talked about how the art of repairing guitars has evolved over the years. They talked about a lot more. They took some advice from, or they took some questions from some of the folks in the audience. It was a great chat. We made that into a podcast. So go back after you've listened to TJ, listen to that. And the Fretboard Summit is going to be happening again in the fall. So if anyone has any great ideas for panel discussions, talks, if there's anyone out there who is dying to perform at this, drop me a line at jason@fretboardjournal.com. We are fielding solicitations right now, and hopefully we'll announce the schedule fairly soon in the next month or so. And hopefully TJ will be there. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to hear from TJ. As always, if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal yet, that's really what it's all about for us, the print magazine. Go to fretboardjournal.com. We will get you started on a print subscription. You won't be disappointed. 4 times a year, 128 pages, great photography, in-depth interviews with guys just like TJ. Thanks so much. Once again, sponsorship of today's podcast comes from our friends at D'Addario & Company. If you're looking for the right acoustic guitar strings for your playing, D'Addario strings are the six that get you. Art and science, passion, and innovation all come to life for unparalleled tone and feel. The six deliver that unmistakable connection to the guitar that makes all the difference in the highly personal pursuit of making music. With unmatched playability, unrivaled consistency, and legendary craftsmanship, D'Addario strings can help you to get whatever personal musical moment you're chasing. For more information and exclusive online content, go visit them at acoustic.daddario.com. We are about to do a Wintergrass Vintage Guitar Workshop, and I know we used plenty of D'Addario's as we set all those fine guitars up. Thanks so much, D'Addario. Here's TJ Thompson. TJ, we talked to you, I guess, what, 3 years ago, and you were in the magazine about that long ago. I got to ask, and one day I'm going to get you drunk and let us convince you to let us. One day I'm going to get you drunk and convince you to let us install a webcam right over your workshop desk. But until then, what is on your bench right now?
That is really funny. It's not going to take much to get me drunk. I can only drink about half a beer.
Then I've got the webcam on order, and we're gonna install it. Yeah, there are webcams for dog daycares. There are webcams for ski resorts. There should be one above your workbench.
That's true. Actually, that's a great idea. That would be wild, and it would probably keep me working at my bench more,
or at least looking busy.
That's right. Yeah. That's a good idea. I'd probably double my income. So I should send you a picture. I'm looking at a 32 OM28, a 31 OM28, okay. A 1930 OM28. A lot of OMs right now. Here's a 32 OM18. Here's a 42D28. There's a Gibson.
What's that doing there? Yeah.
I know. Another 1930 OM28. Here's a 00 12 fret 28 from 1936. And that's everything that's out right now. But that's what I'm looking at right now.
And what varying degrees of repair is going on?
What sort of repairs? Is that what you had?
Yeah.
Well, mostly the standard stuff, neck reset, refret, make a new bridge. The D28 is a different story. That guy bought this guitar in a pawn shop for, I think he said $35. Oh, I don't want to misquote him. It might have been $45.
Okay.
But that was in the 60s. And and it had some, it looks like some, I've seen this guy's work before, some handyman work. maybe his buddy across the street or something.
This guy got around, yeah.
So I have to make a pickguard for it. Don't you wonder what happened to all these pickguards? Like, why are they missing? Why did people ever take them off? I guess maybe to repair the crack, the Martin crack or something, and then they didn't get the proper guard back on. I don't know. This is missing a pickguard. It had a California neck reset, which is the only thing about this that's somewhat tragic, because it's the only repair that I can't really reverse.
Sure.
Right, I'd have to patch it in an eighth of an inch of Brazilian rosewood on the upper part of the back, which I've never attempted. I'm not sure it would look better than just dealing with the repercussions of the California neck set. So.
But I'm sure you've thought about it.
I have thought about it, and I'm thinking about it now. If there's some other way to do that, I'm trying to think of some other, so like really thick binding, you know, that would do it. Yeah. So that's what's going on here. How about you, Soiree? I missed your soiree. Was that back in October?
That was November, the Fretboard Summit. Yeah. We're going to drag you out to the next one. It was great. Many of your friends were there. Mark Stepman was there. Eric Schoenberg, so many people. There was a very large acoustic vintage guitar aficionado contingent. So that was kind of cool.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't heard one bad thing about it. Can you tell me one bad thing about it?
It was a little cold, so we're moving it.
Okay.
We had the music was done in sort of an outside circus tent that we erected, and it got very cold at night. So I'm looking at video footage right now of Matt Munisteri's set, and you can see the fog coming out of his mouth as he sings, which is not a good sign for live video.
Right. Well, sign me up. I'd definitely like to be there next year. I'm glad it sounds like you're doing it again.
We're going to do it again. Yeah. So stay tuned for that. So TJ, you are one of the busiest guys I've ever spoken to. It took months to even get you on the phone for this thing. Why on earth did you decide to open an online luthery equipment store?
Right. Well, the answer is sixfold, but I'll just get started here and see how much of it we can cover. One thing is because Stu Mack sells my tools, and the deal with them is sort of 50-50, right? So they pay me 50% of what they sell them for, and I understand that, and it's all fair and fine. It just makes it difficult for me to continue providing them to them and the masses. At that rate and ratio, because I need to pay for my machine, which costs a little over $100,000, and those bills keep coming in every month. So I was looking for a way to help me cover the cost of the machine, and I figured if I could make a greater percentage of that return, I could pay for this machine more easily. So that was part of my motivation. The second part was, I was so excited about these bridges. I don't know if you know this, but on that website, I've recreated replicas of the bridges that Martin used in the 30s, 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yep.
And I was so excited about that. I'm wondering if something's wrong with me, Jason, because I would have ordered a dozen of those bridges of each type, like immediately if somebody had launched that website. And that hasn't happened. Nobody's ordering these bridges. It was a colossal miscalculation.
I'll order
and
one.
So I don't know what's going on. You know, and then I have you trying to call me to say, let me help you advertise this, because I mean, the only thing I abhor more than self-promotion is advertising. And you're trying to help me out here, and I'm just like dodging the call because I can't stand sales or self-promotion. But that may be why no one's buying any. You know?
Well, let's talk about these bridges, because, I mean, most of us mere mortals will never get their hands on a T.J. Thompson-built guitar. But you are making bridges, and how are you making these? I guess is the first question I should ask you.
Well, I spent probably 200 hours with one of the most talented programmers on the planet. I think by the time he was 18, he was running the machine shop for. He was building space shuttles.
Okay.
And making the nose cones for space shuttles. And there's a picture of him when he looks like a child, and he's sitting down in one of these space shuttle nose cones. I was like, okay, I get the picture now, because he's 40 years old now, so he's very excited about what I do. He doesn't know anything about guitars. He works at a local machine shop, and I happened to meet him, and he was very happy to help me. And I presented him some challenges that he had never faced. I learned a lot along the way. I thought it was going to be a simple matter of just taking the dimensions and making a program, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was painstakingly difficult. I was thinking they must have some sort of a mesh, right, that you could lay over a part and put a vacuum on it that would digitize that form and then translate that information transfer it to the computer.
Sure.
There's no such thing. You know, it seems like we would have that today, but they can take photographs, right? They can take images of it with three different cameras, and you can get a proximity of that image, but it's far from ready to machine. It's hours and hours away from being ready to machine. So it kind of like the idea was a little bit premature, you know, because in the next 5 or 10 years we'll certainly have that mesh that I was dreaming of, but it doesn't exist now. So we sat at the computer for a couple hundred hours, I think, and he patiently made changes to the drawings, and eventually we got it to the place that it machines all of the basics that are needed and necessary for these bridges, and then I can finish them by hand without too much trouble. So it's a dream come true for me. I'm still super excited about it. I would just love to be able to. I thought that everybody was going to have this need. There must be thousands of Martins, old Martins out there that I know they need proper bridges, because I see them coming through here with improper bridges all the time. And I thought I could just solve this problem up front before people glue the wrong bridges on with the wrong footprint. So maybe it's just going to take some time. I don't know. But that was the other thing that I was super excited about, was making these bridges available to the world.
And you, just to backtrack a little bit, you know, people have been making, there are various suppliers, including I think Stumac, who've been doing like pyramid style bridges for a while. What was always disappointing about the aftermarket bridges from your standpoint?
Well, there are a couple of things. I actually bought some of those bridges, but the problem is there's still a lot of handwork to do. They're far from finished. But the reason I couldn't really use them is that they're not selected for super high grade material or grain orientation. So, for instance, a lot of people think that you're supposed to use a quarter sawn piece of wood for a bridge blank. Although it looks nice in that cut, it's they almost always split through the pinholes, and eventually the saddle slot splits too, because you can imagine you're jamming six wedge pins into those six holes, which on many bridges are super close. The bridges I work on are mostly spaced out wider, so they're less likely to split. But on it, for instance, a 2 1/8 inch spacing, those wedge pins you're jamming in there are right next to each other. And they just work to split the bridge wide open through the pinholes. So if it's quarter sawn, that's likely to happen, very likely.
Got it.
So I orient the grain so that won't happen. And that's really important to me, because you don't want to be repairing guitars if you don't have to, especially the bridge area, because you lose a little bit of spruce each time it comes off. So if it's split through the pinholes and you have to take it off unnecessarily just because the wrong piece of wood was used, it doesn't feel like a step forward to me. So these bridges have a lot of sort of aspects that are not immediately evident, like the choice of the material, the choice of the grain orientation.
And was one, you've got the belly and the pyramid, was one harder to kind of duplicate using the computers and everything than the other?
I would say the early 30s was a little more difficult, because the carving is a little more complex and a little more elegant. Oddly, they both have the same asymmetrical footprint. I was surprised. I thought by the 40s they would have corrected that, but if you draw the backside of the bridge and then flip it, they're completely different. The radii are not similar at all, which is, of course, if you're buying a new bridge to stick on there, that's not going to be the case. They're not going to be made incorrectly. And that was one of the things that drove my programmer guy buggy, because those guys are wired to do things correctly. And that's what makes this guy so extraordinary, because he was willing to work with me to make them completely wrong. He took it. He eventually ended up taking it to his machine shop and digitizing. He used a probe. It actually has a little ruby on it, and he just took 1,000 points of contact off the back of my favorite original bridges, and then I read those 1,000 points of contact to him, and he programmed it in point by point into the program, and then tied all those points together.
So
it was really fun to see it. See it come off the machine. It's like a step back in time.
So how were Martin building these back in the day?
That's a really good question. Nobody really knows.
Okay.
I have some ideas about it. I think they were probably doing it with jigs and fixtures.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell exactly, because you can't see machine marks, you can't see sanding marks, and they're all really consistent. They're just beautifully wrongly made. and it's, when you get sensitive to this stuff, it's like, in a second. I can tell from 5 feet away if it's right. But what our brains is registering really is the incorrectness. What stands out is the curves and the radii that are wrong. That's what I say. Maybe there's, I don't know. I thought everybody was going to be excited about it, but maybe not. maybe I should have just made a bridge that was all that wasn't wrong. It would have been so much easier.
Well, I should ask, you're known for your exacting replicas that you create once in a blue moon of these vintage Martins. How were you doing it before you came upon all this technology?
Well, I was making my best, taking my best shot at it, like everybody else still is. But the fact is, you can't make a replica by hand, really. It would be almost impossible. When you see the printout, I have that around here somewhere of just how far off they are. The difference between the curve and the wing on the bass side and the treble, and then the footprint, the difference between the treble and bass side. the surface that's glued down to the guitar top, they're not even close. And it's interesting to see those numbers. I should try to dig up that piece of paper. That might be an interesting interesting piece of trivia. But anyway, I mean, I could get the footprint right because I would copy that off the old bridge. But you can't really get the radii on the curve of the wings right, because you'd have to build. I don't even know how you'd do it. It would just be too much trouble. So we all just make the wings the same, right? So the treble and the bass have the same curve.
Sure.
But that's not the way it is on the old guitars. The bass side had a tighter radius.
Amazing.
Than the treble side. Yeah, so I don't know if there was some drinking involved. My guess is it just had to do
for
with
decades
with the gut. Yeah, right. Well, maybe it's, you know, my guess is it just had to do with the ease of setup with the jig that this person was setting up.
Yeah.
You know, the cut, the fixture that you know, maybe it was the cutters that they had available. I can't imagine that it was by design. Like, why would anybody design the footprint so that the curve on the bass side and the treble side were different?
Yeah.
I can't think of any reason why you would do that, you know, for tonal purposes. It's not impossible, though. I can't say that they didn't do it on purpose. I just can't. I mean, if you think about trying to remanufacture those or recreate them, it's so much more work. So I don't know why they would. I don't know why they would do that. And of course, as time went on, they corrected that or changed it. I don't know if corrected is the right term, but by the late 40s and 50s, the bridge shape changed.
Does this asymmetry cause complications when you're installing these?
Not really. No, it's the same process. You know, if you're making a new guitar, you just have to scribe around it and strip the finish away.
Yeah. I was just gonna I'm wondering: have you gotten any orders for these bridges for new guitars?
No. Nope. Although it's not on the website, I do make a symmetrical one. I put the symmetrical one on my own guitars just because I don't see it as a plus. I don't really. I'm assuming that it was a mistake, that was not intentional, and so we designed one. I just picked the curve that I like best, and made it symmetrical from side to side. It was yet another, you know, session of programming with my guy, but he was happy to do it, and it's kind of fun to see one that's that is correct.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like the old Martin bridge. It changes everything.
This is why folks worship your work, because you're thinking about this stuff when no one else is. Talk to me about some of the other stuff available. And I should mention the site is proluthiertools.com. But what you got bar frets.
Right. That was another thing. I seem to have by default ended up being kind of the world supplier of that bar fret wire just because I needed it so badly. And when Martin stopped making it, I didn't really have a choice. So I set about manufacturing it. And although it's really a money losing proposition selling that stuff. What a pain to put strips of that wire. I wrap it up in cardboard, then I have to tape it so that it's not cutting anybody's hands at the post office, or the cardboard is safe, and then I have to go to the post office and mail it. Anyway, thanks for letting me whine about it.
No.
Because I'll get a message, an email from somebody in Scandinavia who needs a piece of fret wire. It's just, I'm thinking about putting like a 20 piece minimum on it or something, so it's worth my trip to the post office. But I know what it's like to be high and dry and stuck without that stuff.
And it's eight bucks for 2 feet of the fret wire. And you're having this isn't stuff that has been made for other industries and you've figured out that it's the right fit. You have this stuff made just for guitars.
No, right. I wish it had been that easy. Yeah. No, I had to have it roll to the specs and dimensions. Yeah.
and probably to the right metal formula.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And tell me about where do you have this stuff made? Or maybe you don't want to tell me, but was it hard to figure out how to do this?
No, I had it made by a place called Radcliffe Wire that I actually learned about from Ken Parker.
Okay.
This was years ago. I mean, this must have been 10 years ago, but I don't know if you know, but when Ken was manufacturing the Parker Fly, he used stainless steel wire.
Yeah.
And there's no fret hang on it. It's just epoxied right to the graphite board, to the fingerboard.
Yeah.
And so he had to have that stainless wire manufactured with no tang. So he kind of got to know this guy. I forget his name now. I think it was Chris Radcliffe. Anyway, he put me in touch with him. He was great. He's like, oh, no, we'll get it done for you. I've tried since, and it hasn't worked out. I've tried to have some stuff remade, and I think he might be gone, and I just haven't had any luck getting it remanufactured there. But I may try again. I still have a lot of that wire. I understand why Martin stopped selling it. It's mostly a waste of time and energy. You know, somebody orders a piece of wire, like what? You know, I need a full-time employee just to wrap up pieces of wire. So I waste a lot of time doing that, but every time I go to the post office, I feel like I'm bailing somebody out, one of my fellow luthiers, and I know what it's like to be without these parts and need that stuff so badly. So,
and are you no,
it's still
are you using that on your new guitars?
Today,
yeah, are you using that on your new guitars?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I had to manufacture it, because it's really it's the only wire I've ever used, I think. Yeah, I think that's true.
And I think, if I remember correctly, 3 years ago you were saying that Tony Rice expressed some interest in the bar frets. Did that ever happen?
Yeah. No, because I think Tony's health sort of declined.
Yeah.
And he started playing less and less.
Yeah.
It became less of an issue, I think, because his problem was when he would be on a hot stage, right? That's when, because he would have the neck pressed and it would be fine. And then when he was on in the sun playing a gig or something, the neck would pull forward from the heat.
Got it.
So that was the problem. And I think that's, you know, I'm sorry to say, I think that's not a problem he's having now. I wish he were still having that problem, so we were still getting to hear him play, but I don't think that's in the cards in the near future anyway.
Got it. And tell me a little bit more about some of the other stuff on your site.
Well, I think everything I have on this site, no, that's not true. I sell some stuff on the site that Stu Mac doesn't sell. Those are the items that I'd really like to tell you about, because I was as excited about those two repair tools as I was about the bridges. And I thought every repair shop is going to want this. And guess how many I've sold? Pretty much zero.
All right. I'm noticing a trend here, sadly.
It's unbelievable. I mean, Frank Ford ordered one of the tools, but I can't even remember how that came about. How did he hear about it? I ordered one of his string winders, and I think he felt he owed me a sale, maybe. I don't know, but he said they're really enjoying it and finding good use for it. So, so that tool is called a saddle top shaper.
Okay.
It's a carbide cutter head with three different profiles for three different saddle sizes: 100 thousandths, 110, and 120. So it has. If you can picture that, those three different sort of half circles.
Yeah.
You know, imagine that. It's a triangle with three half circles on it. So you can just flip it and select the one that you need for the saddle that you're working on. But the great thing about it is, if you're working on a bridge that has a glued-in saddle, like, for instance, a through saddle in an old Martin-style bridge,
sure.
It's just tough to get down there, right? Because some of those saddles are super low. They're less than an eighth of an inch in many cases. And you're trying to get in there with sandpaper or files, and it's easy to mess up the top of the bridge. This allows you to get right down to the very end of the saddle and put the right radii on the top of it. So
I'm looking at it now on your site. It's gorgeous. It's like the
you can see
the string winder. Yeah.
So and it looks like it costs a fortune, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because I used to be one of those guys going through the Stumac catalog saying, what, $58? I ain't paying no $58 for this. And now I'm looking at it going, $58? How can they sell this tour for $58? I'll take two of these, because it means that the guy who made it sold it to them for, you know, I mean, half of that.
Sure.
And now I don't even know how anybody can manufacture tools for and make, you know, offer them for sale. It's an expensive process. And that thing that you're looking at, that saddle top shaper, I don't even know if I'm making money on it. To have that carbide, those three different profiles cut in that carbide head is so involved that it's not clear that I'm actually making money. It costs so much money to have that done. But that's the kind of thing that I didn't think about until I got into this, which really happened because Stumac said they were selling my belly reducers, and they said, we'd like to have a whole page of your tools. So I thought, okay, I better bring some of these ideas to fruition and figure out which ones are marketable. So that's how that came about, because I'd kind of had that idea in the back of my head, and I thought I'd try it. But of course, going from the dream state to reality is a whole different deal. And it turns out that the one guy who can really do that the way I want, cut those profiles, won't do it. He said it's so impractical. He has to make a grinder for each of those shapes and then keep making a new grinder because the grinders wear away. So those are actually cut with an electronic wire. It's a process called EDM. And those shapes are cut underwater with an electric, with a thin wire that has an electrical current going through it. It's just the craziest thing. It's a cool space age thing, but it's still not, that's still not exactly what I would like. It's just that to do it the way I really want, I don't even know if it's possible. and those work pretty well, even off the EDM wire. The ground ones are polished to a buff surface that you can see yourself in, and they glide like it's ice. And that's what I really want, but I just haven't been able to make that happen. So,
wow.
So that may be TMI, but that's one of the tools that I thought every shop is going to want this. Mark Stutman has one and at Folkway Music, and he was super excited about it. And that may be how Frank heard about it. I'm not sure. Maybe Mark posted something on, that's right, he posted an Instagram of himself using it, and maybe Frank saw it there. I don't know. But I thought every shop in the country would want that thing, you know? It's even handy for the saddles that you can pull out of the bridge, the modern saddles. You know, you can just put them in a vise and use that tool to round it. But the glued-in saddles, I can't imagine doing it the old way anymore without that tool.
Amazing.
That's one. Sorry, did you have a question, another question about that tool?
Go ahead.
So the other tool that I thought every repair shop would want that Stumac is not selling is the back crack repair kit. If you're on the website, you can bring that up and take a look.
Okay.
That's something that I wanted, I sort of could imagine and envision in my dreams, but never figured out how to make it a reality. And that's because you couldn't buy those N52, whatever they're called, neodymium magnets, the rare earth magnets. They weren't available to the general public. So there was no way to pull that off, but those magnets have 27 pounds of pull each. And so when you combine them, it's if you're using the one that has three magnets, it's basically 50 pounds times three. So it's kind of like putting a clamp on it right through the guitar, which is just, it's just fantastic. It's just the easiest way I've ever found to repair a crack in a back.
And those aren't flying off the shelves either, or they're doing okay?
I don't think I've sold one. Oh no, maybe Evan Gluck bought one. I think Evan Gluck bought one, but it doesn't really count because I think I talked him into it. Poor Evan.
So I mean, he asked me,
you know, what do you think I can't live without? And I told him about that in the saddle shape, where I think he's the only guy who ordered them.
So if anyone listening to this wants to place an order, they're going to be in really good company, where it's like Frank Ford, Mark Stutman.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You know.
But do you have luthiers? See, I mean, I have lots of hits on my website, but I don't think they're luthiers. I mean, do you have luthiers listening to this program?
Who knows who listens to this program? But a lot of people do, so we'll see. You tell me in about a week.
Okay. Well, maybe... they'd make nice gifts for people, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there is something artistic about all these things. They are beautiful in their own right. You always, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, you're always looking at technology. You've mentioned this $100,000 machine. I'm assuming that's a CNC machine or something else.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
I know Mark Stutman currently is borrowing some sort of magical $2,000 thing that measures the thickness of a finish. What is that?
Well, it's actually a tool I first heard about from Julius Borges, I think, who is ahead of that curve. He was very frustrated, as I recall, sanding through or buffing through the finish He's one of those guys who tends to look into this stuff more deeply than I do, and he discovered this tool that checks finish gauges, finish thickness, the film build on. It's really for the furniture industry.
Okay.
They've had these for cars for a long time, and it's easier to measure this on a car because of the metal substrate, but it's tougher on wood. So this is done with ultrasonic, the same way, you know, you would look at a baby inside of a womb. I don't understand exactly how it works, but it measures off of the wood and then tells you exactly how thick the film build is on top of it. So I knew I had to have one. It just backs up your suspicions, right? So if you think, I think this is probably refinished, but, you know, your client doesn't want to hear it, and you put that on it and say, well, the spec at the time was 2.5 mil, and we're looking at 8.7, you know? So they say, oh, okay, sorry, you're right. So it just helps back up your guess about what you're looking at. I don't feel like I really need that to know if something's refinished, but it's useful in that situation, and it's also useful in building new guitars because I don't like buffing through either. I like my finishes to be super thin, but I don't want to buff through on the last round of polishing. So you can check it and see, you know, if you're down to two thousandths of an inch, you got to be super careful. But it's a way of sort of tracking and following just how much trouble you're about to get into.
And did you go to town and sort of gauge the thickness of finishes on all the vintage Martins you had in the shop when you first got it?
I couldn't help myself, yeah.
And how, for the ones that weren't refinished, how close were they?
Oh, you mean from one to the other?
Yeah.
They're super consistent. You know, somewhere between, in general, 2.5 mil to... maybe mid 5,000ths, you know, so maybe 5.4 or something like that. That's the range that you typically see. The question is, what was it originally, right? And nobody knows that, but because the plasticizers and solvents are bleeding off every year. I mean, that's probably done by now, but that finish was certainly thicker when it was new, and it keeps shrinking. So, you know, it may have been, it probably was 6,000, 8,000 off the shelf.
Yeah.
You know, out of the Martin gate, but who really knows? So, you know, so it's a little nervous making to make a finish now that's 2,000 or 3,000 thick. What's going to happen to that in 70 years? You know, is that going to be down to 0.5?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, but I won't be around to worry about it. So, you know, will there be any finish left? You know, because we're all working to make super thin finishes like the vintage guitars, but they weren't that thin to start with. So I don't really know what the right thing to do is. I just try to keep mine under 5 mil.
Yeah. Any other technology toys in your arsenal right now that are new?
Well, funny you should ask, because in the last, let's see, 2 days, just 2 days, I think, I had this situation come up where I'm working on this super rare guitar that I can't even tell you about, but it has these super rare tuners on it. And those tuners are not available. Like the last set that sold, sold for $5,000. So I realized, what am I going to do? So anyway, I found a set that was nickel, but I need gold. So then I'm like, now what do I do? So anyway, I remembered that I had this stuff for plating, because let's get in the time machine and go back maybe 12 years or when Stumac first reissued the Waverly tuners, they put them out with bronze gears. Actually, I don't think they still have that. I have to look to be sure, but I was so psyched. I thought, oh, great. You know, now I can put these on the vintage guitars, but I couldn't because they had bronze gears. And I needed nickel. I needed nickel plating. They just looked dopey to me with bronze gear. So I couldn't use those for replacement tuners. So I bought all the plating stuff a dozen years ago and started plating the gears myself so they would look right. And then I made a bunch of other changes. But the gear was the main problem. I had all that stuff. I remembered, I've got that stuff in the attic. So I went in the attic and pulled it all down. I thought, can these chemicals still be good after a dozen years? And fired that machine up, and I'm telling you, they are beautiful. I should send you a picture.
You should.
They're just stunning. And so it worked beautifully. It worked better than I could have imagined. And so now I have the gold-plated tuners I needed. But then I thought, well, wait a second, what about, I wonder if I could just plate a button, because I traded tuners with a buddy / client last week who felt really bad because he needed a set of 30s D18 or 18 style tuners, and he had a set of 30s 28 style tuners, and so we switched, but one of the buttons, the plating was peeling off. And so it was down to the bronze, and he just felt terrible. He was like, oh, it just looked awful. I feel terrible giving you this. And I said, I don't care. I don't care about the plating. And that was last week before I dug this out of the attic. And so yesterday I was thinking, I do have some nickel plating solution. Why don't I see if I can just plate a button? So I did. I went through the whole process. It looked like Breaking Bad over here. I had my Walter White outfit on, the goggles, the gloves, the smock, the whole thing.
Sure.
And I electrically, what do they call it? They call it electro cleaning. I cleaned the button, scrubbed it all down, and then I cleaned it electronically, and then I put it in the acid dip, and then I put it in the chrome solution. You charge it an anode, positively, right? That's sitting in a solution, and then you negatively charge, in this case, the tuner. So I just clipped the negative contact on the tuner itself and dipped the button in and held it for 4 minutes. And so electronically it's sucking the particles out of the solution, onto the button. And I thought, this can't really work. This is just too easy. I pulled it out. It looks like new. So I'm super excited about that today, because I've seen so many of those buttons with the plating, flaking off.
Yeah.
And, it looks like the other five tuners now. So I sent the guy a picture. He said, oh, that's fantastic. You know, it's like the load was off of his mind. And I didn't know that, you know, last week. I didn't realize I had the stuff in the attic to do this, but that was an exciting thing that just happened yesterday. I thought I would share with people, because it is possible to do. You have to be super careful. Because I did order the videos with this 10 or 12 years ago, but they were never open.
VHS.
I had a buddy. Yeah, right. I had a helper named Cam who really wanted to do this. He'd always been excited about plating. And so he just took it over and he plated all the gears for me. So I never learned to do it back then. And I noticed that the videos hadn't been open. I was like, oh, Cam, you didn't even watch the instruction videos. But he wasn't the kind of guy to read instructions. And I can't really blame him. I opened them up and I started watching them. The first 15 minutes is warning you about all the ways you can die from doing this. So, you have to be super careful. But, man, it was so fun to see the result.
So then the million-dollar question is, do you relic that button to make it look like it's old, or do you keep it nice and shiny?
Well, that depends on what guitar it's going on. And this particular guitar is near mint condition, so I don't have to do much relicking.
Okay.
But you can kind of control that with the acid dips and stuff, like how much tarnish it has and how much you buff it.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to leave some of the tarnish on this so it doesn't look brand new. But I do have tumblers and stuff for that, so I certainly can distress them if I need to.
Yeah.
I just put it in a... Actually, I have a number of them, but one of them, the simplest thing that's easily accessible is just a rock tumbler.
Yeah.
I just bought a little rock tumbler, and you can throw it in there with some media. I use ceramic, but, you know, they sell walnut shells and all kinds of different stuff that you can throw in there with it, and they'll come out looking 50 years old if you leave them in there long enough.
Amazing.
Surprisingly long. Like, you have to leave them for more than a day to really see a result.
Got it. And are you working on any new TJ instruments?
Well, that's my plan this year. My one way or another, I'm going to find a way to say no to some of these restoration projects that keep coming in here. It's just every time something comes along that I don't know where to send them, and I don't want to say no because it's like one of the coolest vintage guitars on the planet. So I keep taking this stuff in, and it's just tough to get to the building. But I do, any of my clients listening to this who are waiting for a guitar know that I have you in mind, and I absolutely am going to get to it one way or another. I just have to get better at saying no to this repair stuff.
Amazing. Sounds good. Well, hopefully by the next time we talk, we can install that webcam over your desk. And
we'll
render podcasts obsolete. People will just be able to tune in 24/7 and see what you're up to.
Red, I'll be like one of those eagles or vultures in the nest.
Exactly.
Watching the egg.
And the site is proluthiertools.com. And if you want to drive TJ nuts, order the fret material. Is that right?
right, and don't order repairs on there. People keep, I'm like, I see the email come in, I'm like, oh, look, an email in order, and then I open this, like, yeah, I've got a blah, 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 and I need blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, please, there's nothing on that website that says, please contact me if you need repair work done.
You're the only
how to drive me crazy.
You're the only guitar repair man who's trying to hide from clients. It's amazing.
Exactly. Right. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, that's why it took you so long to get me on the phone. Yeah. but I do enjoy talking to you, and I want to support your great effort. And if you don't mind me hijacking this podcast for a minute, has anyone interviewed you?
No.
I would like to hear a podcast about you.
All right. You can do that next time.
Okay, because I'm curious about how and why you got into this field, other than the obvious money and fame. But
yeah, we all have our fret wire.
Right. Well, I'd love to hear that podcast, Jason.
Thanks, TJ.
You bet. Okay, anytime.